Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's just gone 6 minutes past the hour of nine. Welcome to the social program on Radio Islam International. My name is Habib Bobat, and inshallah I'll be keeping you company this morning right up till 10 a.m. This morning we've got a very interesting program lined up for you, especially for people who are intending to get married or who are in a marriage and would like to sort matters out. And we've got a very interesting contract prepared by the Jamiatul Ulama, the Islamic prenuptial contract. And we've got Mawlana Ibrahim Baum in the studios who will be taking us through this contract from the start, inshallah. Mawlana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And assalamu alaikum to all the listeners, and wonderful to be in the studios.
Mawlana, just a brief background to our program today.
Yes, Mawlana, together with myself, inshallah, during the course of the program, we will also be getting in touch with Mufti Minti, who is the head of the social department of the Jamiatul Ulama. And we will be speaking about this Islamic prenuptial contract. Obviously, many people will ask, what are the reasons, what is the need for a contract? And perhaps people would ask the question, that can a marriage work by a contract? Would it work by a contract, or is marriage beyond a contract? Is it love, understanding, spontaneity? These are the type of questions that would be asked. We would also be looking at some of the aspects of the contract. Perhaps also ask why has the Jamiat embarked on the contract? Because for some many years people have been speaking about the need for a contract, and I will give the background with regard to why the need arose. In the contract there are certain clauses that we will sort of perhaps be going through to see what exactly does the contract say, and how does it impact upon our life. But I think these are important points, especially given the situation that we are living in. Perhaps previously there was not a need, for example, to ascertain the HIV status of your partner and your spouse. It would have been, you know, taken for granted that people would come into marriage with a certain degree of purity. Nowadays people would want to know and would want to ascertain situations. I'm not saying that it's going to be one size fits all. Everyone would want to do that. But these are situations that have arisen in our community, and the Jamiatul Ulama have taken that into account and have prepared these guidelines and this Islamic prenuptial contract. Very importantly, not for every marriage couple, or not for everyone who wants to, but there are going to be situations that parents are not comfortable. The spouses perhaps need more reassurance from one another on certain aspects. And these are some of the points that have been addressed in the contract. But I suppose we will, inshallah, be dealing with it as we go along in the program.
Yes, and one of the difficulties that we face is that Muslim marriages in South Africa are not legally recognized. And the non-recognition of our marriages makes it difficult for couples to effectively resolve issues, especially during times of conflict. And that is why we have this contract, which will help to a certain level, you know, iron out those issues, inshallah. We will be discussing this just after the short ad break. The SMS line to the program, 48855, that's 48855. Alternatively, the WhatsApp studio number is 0727861548, or tweet Mawlana Baum on @IbrahimBaum. Yes, we are looking at the Islamic prenuptial contract, which is designed and formulated by the Jamiatul Ulama. We have Mawlana Baum on the program, and also Mufti Minti, who will be joining us telephonically from the Jamiat branch in Johannesburg. Mawlana, we'll hand over to you, and then inshallah you can take us through the procedure.
Yes, Mawlana, let me start off by saying Muslim marriages in South Africa are not legally recognized unless it is done through a dedicated and an official marriage officer, or it is done through the means of the court. And that also, there are certain type of contracts that are allowed, and from the Shari point of view, certain that are not allowed. The non-recognition of our marriages make it difficult for couples to sometimes effectively resolve issues, especially during times of conflict. So when the conflict comes, when things are going well, alhamdulillah, we all know, mia biwi razi, to kya kare kazi. So there is no need for any judge, no arbiter, no mediator if things are going well. You don't need outside interference, you don't need outside influence. And as far as possible, it would be nice if couples and Muslim families resolve the issues within the family, and perhaps even better within themselves. However, sometimes it does happen that things do not go according to plan. And then how do you deal with the issues? How do you deal with, for example, the aspect of assets, the aspect of both the husband and wife working? How do you resolve issues with regard to, for example, terminal illness? Not only HIV. HIV is one of the aspects. How do you, for example, resolve issues pertaining to one partner wants a talaq and wants to be out of the marriage, the other one doesn't want to and wants to maintain the marriage even if the other partner might not be agreeable? These are issues that the contract tries to resolve, tries to bring into it. Aspects of having a marriage contract where both the parties are legally and morally and from the Sharia point of view are contracted.
Mm.
And they are obliged to adhere to what they have agreed upon.
Mm.
Bear in mind that before the contract is signed, things are up in the air. There are certain things that you can enforce, certain things cannot be enforced. But when you do agree upon certain things, then of course you by your own volition and your own will have taken it upon yourself to agree and adhere to that. And once you have adhered to it, then for you to afterwards say that I'm not happy with it, it's not correct. So you have the aspect of agreeing, not agreeing. But also is it important that maybe perhaps people need to go through the clauses. They will need to go through the agreements. This is a standard agreement which is drawn up by the Jamiat, where people who intend getting married, and of course there are two types of contract. There is a pre-nuptial and there is a post-nuptial. There is one before marriage and one after marriage.
Mm.
Perhaps people who are married for a long time, if there is problems, they can sit down and reach an agreement and do it in writing. You can use certain clauses of this contract, but it is not something that is compulsory for you to go by each and every clause. So I think these are some of the reasons why people have, and the Jamiat have looked into it. And of course, not only that, because of the many type of complexities that have arisen because of assets and because of when there is a talaq, how do you deal with the assets? Sometimes even with regard to gifts.
Mm.
Now, after when there is things are going well, you will buy all types of gifts. You will buy a ring and you will buy chocolates and all of those type of things. And then afterwards, when things don't go so well, then you start demanding it. Now, these are the type of things that the contract does speak about.
Mm.
And that is not the only aspect, but these are some of the aspects that the contract goes on to speak about. And I personally feel in places where things are not so, so
certain. Mm.
Maybe the parents are not so certain with regard to the groom, or maybe vice versa. These type of things does protect the individual going into a marriage.
Let's bring on Mufti Minti onto the program. Mufti Sahab, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mufti Sahab, Mullah Abam has just given us a brief outline to the contract itself, but you were involved in it from day one. Perhaps you would want to give us some background to the contract itself?
I think, all honesty, I haven't been involved from day one. It was the idea and a lot of the effort that's went into this contract has been the effort of Ma Yusuf Patel, who is the head of our Middleburg branch, but we've been in many consultations thereafter.
Mm.
I think what's important, and just as an introduction, is to understand the nature of our society and our community on two levels, just as a prelude and introduction to the discussion. The first is that the nature of the family unit has evolved, it's changed in the past 20, 30 years. Primarily in the past we had one earner, one income earner in the house, and that was the father. Either through a business or some form of employment, the mother was at home. There was no real form of income that she had of her own. She might have ran some small little home industry, but he was a primary earner. And so that was a dynamic. There were not two incomes, two people contributing, two spouses. That's the one dynamic that's changed, because now in most households, most family units, the father and mother both are working, husband and wife both have an income. So that dynamic has changed. the other dynamic which we need to also keep in mind is that in terms of resolving issues in the past, we've always had this situation where the family would get involved first. Mm. So if the parties between them couldn't resolve their issues, then they would seek assistance from the extended family, and more often than not, the matter was resolved in that sphere. But we also need to understand one very important aspect is that when the matter was resolved, what that culminated in was either a reconciliation and the parties, the couple got together, or there was a dissolution of that marriage in the form of a talaq and the parties parted. Issues related to the children, custody, access, visitation, maintenance, iddat maintenance, those issues were never discussed. Was the father given access, not given access? It just depended on whether the father was really interested or not, or whether the wife or the mother allowed him or not. And that really didn't come to the fore. Our community has developed even in terms of the Islamic awareness, and people are more aware of their rights. Mm-hmm. Ladies are more aware of their rights. Fathers are more aware of their rights. Mothers are more aware of the Islamic rights. And when the couples have started challenging or asking for their rights, it created a turbulence within our community. Where previously the father, the kids would live with the mother, and access would be determined on terms decided by the mother and the in-laws. The father said, "But I do have a right to see my kids." And previously, where the father shirked his responsibility in maintenance, the mother would now says, "But I have not only a legal right, but also an Islamic right." And also in terms of the finances, where in the dissolution of a marriage previously, the father contributed everything. He went away with the assets. The husband moved out of that relationship in the marriage with the assets. Nowadays, the wives are also contributing. So the one might be contributing to the running expense of the house, the other towards the bond, etc. And at the point of termination or dissolution of the marriage, these issues and these challenges arise, the dispute and conflict, and then just, you know, degenerate. So that's the backdrop, I think, of this contract. The other important thing to keep in mind is that as a Muslim community, we're not regulated in any way. We live in a secular state, and the secular state decides on all aspects of our lives. So there's laws that are applicable to every citizen of the state, and which we cannot get away from it. So if we cannot resolve our issue, we can go to the state. Sorry for that. And does the state always give us a solution that's Islamically viable, Islamically consistent with Islam? We know the answer is it isn't. So perhaps that's a bit of the backdrop of where the contract has come from and why the need, and perhaps we'll continue with the discussion as we move forward.
The one question, Mana, you have explained the need. Would some people say that marriage is a relationship which is based on love and understanding? وَمِنْ آيَاتِي أَنَ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا. Allah has granted you a spouse so that you can gain comfort from one another. And Allah has put mawaddat and rahmat, love and mercy, between the two who are intending to get married. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala takes that guarantee. Would a contract of this nature, where you start discussing issues pertaining to assets, pertaining to tafwid al-talaq, which is obviously quite a bold step, when you discuss issues with regard to HIV status, does it take away from that love? Does it take away from that mawaddah? Does it take away from that understanding?
Mama, I thought you'd be helping me with the answers.
That's a good question to ask.
I will also help you. So I'm playing two roles, a host and also doing the answering on behalf of the organization.
So at the basis of every marriage is exactly as Maulana has explained, that it is based on love and compassion. And that's what makes a marriage. We know the Islamic mindset and the mindset of the Sharia is we're always concerned of whether we're fulfilling the rights of the other and our responsibilities towards others, as opposed to our rights being fulfilled. That's the mindset, the Sharia mindset. And if every couple and every marriage is every couple focuses on their responsibility towards their spouse and making the marriage a success, then there would be no need to have a contract or to bind ourselves to something in writing. And that is what Islam encourages also, because in every marriage, a marriage doesn't succeed on rights and responsibilities. Every spouse within a marriage relationship contributes much more than what is their responsibility. You know, so you wouldn't have any couple, and no marriage will survive on this. Where couples, it's not a business contract. It's not cold as making profits, investing capital and making profits, and who gets the maximum. It's more, it's an emotional relationship. So every couple, every spouse, the amount that they put in is what they're going to get out. So that's the ideal, and every marriage should be based on that. The question is, will a marriage contract, take us away from that, remove us from that? If we go through a marriage contract, most of what's contained in the marriage contract is what the Shariah has already allowed. It's laws and rights and responsibilities that the Shariah has already granted. And let's just take ourselves one step back. If as a Muslim community, if we lived under an Islamic state, in a state where our matters are regulated in terms of Sharia law, in an Islamic country, for example, under a Khalifa, then many of the aspects that are contained within the contract would be secured for us by the state. Let's just look at one simple example. In the instance of, I'm just looking at page 3 of the contract, the first clause there relates to mahar and dowry. We often hear ladies saying that I'm married and I haven't received my dowry since I got married. I was promised that it is in a safe or in a safe deposit box or it's in a safe somewhere hidden away. Under the control of the husband.
Which doesn't make it the wives.
Which doesn't make it the
wives. From the Sharia point of view, yeah.
And I still haven't received it to date. Mm-hmm. Now, in the absence of, we know that the secular state is not going to, South African is not going to, the law is not going to decide on matters of mahar. They might decide, but these are issues which are related to a nikah. If we went to the Qazi would order the husband that this is the right of the wife. You have no right to have control over it. She must be given ownership. If she decides on her own to do that. So many of the clauses in the contract are rights that have already been given to the wife or the husband by the Shariah. It's not something new that we bring about. It's a form of self-regulation. In an Islamic state, we'll be regulated by the state. The state would be the arbiter. They would, if any party is not fulfilling the rights of the other, the state would step in and then, provide those rights. In the absence of that, as a Muslim community, we don't like to be regulated. That's our reality. We don't want to be regulated by the state. We don't want to be regulated by Islam. And we often hear people choosing the option that best suits them. In the dissolution of a marriage, when it comes to the division of the assets, it's so unfortunate that people will look at what's in their best interest, not depending on Sharia, what's in their best interest, taking both laws in mind. So if a party feels, if I use the secular law and I benefit greater than using the Sharia law, then they're going that route, unfortunately, right, because we don't want to be regulated.
Can I just maybe come in now? I've asked a question. Does it take away from the love that is supposed to be in a marriage? And I'm going to wear a different cap now. One is a cap of being asking the questions, and one is also perhaps giving some form of answer. And I think maybe after this question, we will throw open the lines and ask people if they have any specific questions with regard to what a marriage is supposed to be and what this marriage contract that you are talking about. I hope that maybe out to the listeners, we are not talking something that is beyond the reach or beyond the understanding of many people. People do take this program to be something in which we talk things maybe of maybe a little lighter note, not so serious, something that we talk about personal relationship, interpersonal relationships from our beloved Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and other examples. Here we are talking about things that are maybe perhaps to do with contractual agreements, etc. But maybe just to ask the point, and maybe some people can come in from the listeners. The Quran refers to marriage as mithaqan ghaliza, as a sacred and a very strong contract. So marriage, together with it being a bond of love and affection, is also, to an extent and to a great extent, a civil agreement. A contract which gives rise to certain rights and obligations, certain duties and responsibilities, on behalf of each and every spouse. It is advisable that couples explicitly commit themselves to fulfilling the obligation in order to avoid potential conflict. A great deal of heartache can be avoided if couples agree to enter into a prenuptial contract, for those contemplating marriage and a post-nuptial contract for those already married. But obviously, in the post-nuptial contract, it becomes much more difficult because people are set in their ways. And then, of course, to come into agreement is much more difficult. But, of course, with understanding, everything is possible. Prenuptial, there is a certain degree of desire to get married. And maybe at that time, people will put everything down in writing and they will agree upon things, which might be later, they might not. A marriage contract, therefore, and I think it's important for people to understand, is not a planned exit strategy. Mm. Nor is it that I'm going into the marriage, that it's not going to work, I'm going to get out. It's not like that. It serves perhaps as a basis for a transparent, honest and mature relationship. It also serves as protection against unforeseen, quote-unquote, what-if circumstances.
Mm.
So, just bear this in mind, and maybe people can comment on this. If, for example, you get into a marriage and one partner tells the other partner that, listen, I'm going to look after you, I'm going to care for you, I'm going to give you a mahar, and this is what's going to happen, and with regard to our assets, I will look after you, whatever assets you want to give into the marriage, you can give it on your own volition. From the Shari point of view, you are not obliged. Let us discuss on what basis you are going to give your earnings into the marriage, how, if, when, and on what basis. Right? Now, what actually happens is it can enhance love when one partner sees that, listen, man, this other partner of mine is prepared to actually put down that on paper, not only on words, but actually put it down that I'm committed to this.
Mm.
So it does make for a transparent, honest and mature relationship in many instances. Mm. I'm not saying in every instance.
We are discussing the Islamic prenuptial contract designed and formulated by the Jamiatul Ulama department. And just to give you some perspective and insight into what we are discussing, this is a contract which comprises of 6 pages. The first page carries the definitions of the terms that will be used in the contract. Then they've got the agreement page. And some of the things discussed in there, which we will ask Mufti Saab to shed light, inshallah, in a few moments. They speak about mahar, property regime. They speak about duty of support. They speak about gifts. They speak about mediation, divorce settlement agreement, talaq al-tafwid, which is the most important one, which we will discuss also, inshallah. Then amendments, and this is basically what they are discussing in the contract, 10 to 11 issues discussed in here, and it's a short contract, and you have the understanding behind why and the need and etc. But we'll go into the contract and more into that just after this ad break.
And when things have changed, you know, previously you used to make one or two jokes, like, you know, you used to say the man before marriage yearns for the woman whom he's going to get married to, and afterwards the why becomes silence and he earns for her, right? So, and someone, a young child, went to and asked the father, oh, my father, how much does it cost to get married? And the father replied and said, my son, I don't know, I'm still paying. So those things have changed now. Now there's a whole situation. Now, when we talk about change, just a very important point. Many times, I'm sure the elderly people in who are listening to Radio Islam, they will say this, Mawlana's and Jamiyas have brought new things and they've made things even more complex. We hope that things could have been the way it was, but of course things are not the way it is.
Mm.
And to ignore reality, ignore change, does not change reality. It just makes us in a disadvantaged situations of not being prepared for that reality. So ignoring change doesn't change the reality. The reality remains. But all it does is you are not as prepared for that change. And I think we can discuss this after the break if we're having one.
Yes, let's go for a quick commercial break. In the meanwhile, you can send us your interactions via Twitter or SMS. As Mufti Minty alluded earlier on, that things have changed and the nature of the family unit have changed from what was previously in the past 20 to 30 years, and lots of things have evolved. And so, accordingly, we also need to adapt and protect this very sacred union of nikah, and we all go into nikah with this intention of happily ever after, but sometimes things don't work out like that. We have scholars in the past like Mullah Ashraf Ali Thani rahmatullahi, penning down books like Al-Hilatul Najiza, which discusses such masail. We have to accept the reality that sometimes things don't work out as we plan, and in that situation We want the best for both parties, and that is where this contract fits into. And we're going to ask Mufti Sabri, inshallah, take us through the contract itself. We have spoken about the contract, the background and the backdrop behind the contract. Let's go into the contract itself, Mufti Sab.
Before going into the contract, just one point with regard to whether, you know, will this take couples away from getting married for love? The reality is that if any couple, whether there is a contract or there isn't a contract, are going to focus on rights and responsibilities from the first day of the marriage, which we do come across, you know, now and then, the marriage is never going to succeed. That's whether there is a contract or there is no contract. More often than not, couples go into a relation, into a marriage, because they want the marriage to succeed. They want to make the best out of it. And even when the marriage, you know, is not going forward, and they're not making progress, then too, they still try heart and soul to try and make the marriage work. The issue is that when it comes to where they then start reflecting on the rights and responsibilities. For instance, if a husband isn't fulfilling the financial obligations towards his wife and he isn't maintaining her, it's not from the first day or the first month or the first year where the wife would argue and want out of the relationship. But over a period of time, progressively, she starts feeling that she has no value in the husband's eyes. He doesn't make any effort to take care of her, look after her, provide for her. She sort of loses importance in his life, and that makes her want to leave the relationship more than just that her right isn't being fulfilled. So the rights, I think, if the contract, whether there is a contract or no contract, if people are going to focus on rights and responsibilities, that marriage will be a failure. If they focus on making the marriage work, then it will be a success whether there is a contract or not. The contract is merely allowing them to regulate their lives, and from the first day, know exactly what are they contracting to, what are their rights, what are their basic responsibilities within the structure of nikah.
Very interesting. Perhaps we can spend this last 15 minutes of the program discussing the contract itself.
Okay, we'll go very quickly through it since time is of the essence. We go through the most significant clauses. Obviously, the listeners don't have the contract in front of them. So the first one we'll discuss is mahar. Mahar is the right of the wife. And it is her, once mahar has been decided, she has the right to decide the amount of mahar that's contained in the contract. She has the right to decide whether the mahar will be paid in cash or on credit. In other words, deferred at a later point in time. When will that deferred mahar be paid to her, at which point? And the important thing here is that it is her ownership. In the event of a divorce, it becomes a debt the husband has to pay to her. Even in the instance of a death, it becomes a debt to the estate. And this is securing this right of the wife. The second important clause here is that of the property regime. We all, or many of us, might be aware that in South Africa we have this concept or the idea of community of property, where as a result of marriage, the assets of the couple are joined. And the asset is joined, the estate is joined. They own all assets jointly. In terms of the Sharia, this is in conflict with the Sharia, and the Sharia law is that whatever assets belong to the husband before and in the marriage, and to the wife before and during the subsistence of the marriage, at the point when the marriage terminates, either through death or through divorce, each spouse would retain ownership of their own asset. And they will not join the asset. But what's important is, which is contained in this agreement, agreement, is that the parties, the husband and wife, have a right to contract outside of this agreement, outside of the marriage. If they want to own a business jointly, they want to go into a partnership, they want to own property jointly, that doesn't preclude them. So they need to then have, and Islam allows for that. So they then need to enter into those contracts, those agreements, separately, outside of the scope of nikah, because nikah is a separate entity in Shariat, and ownership and partnership and ownership of assets jointly is a separate concept, and these two need to be kept separately. The fourth clause is the duty of support. In Islam, in terms of Shari'i law, the husband's primarily responsible or fully responsible for the maintenance of his wife. Irrespective of her financial position, whether she is wealthy or whether she isn't, whether she can provide for herself or not, it remains his responsibility. And obviously this would be based on needs versus necessity. needs versus ability. What are the needs of the wife and what's the ability of the husband? The fifth clause relates to gifts. All gifts that have been given to either party during the subsistence of the marriage would remain their respective properties, at, you know, whether in the marriage or after the marriage at the point of death or divorce. Unfortunately, you know, that's just some of the motivations of this contract. It's so normal and common in our community that when there is a divorce, the first thing is asked, whatever I've given to you, give it back to me. Give the jewelry back to me. We want the jewelry. Or the wife would ask that, do I have to return the jewelry? Do I have to return the gifts? And this is totally, you know, totally in conflict with what Islam teaches us. So this is securing the rights and ownership of gifts that have been given. There's one clause here which could be controversial, and that is with regard to contagious diseases or the HIV status.
Mana, before you go on to the contagious diseases, obviously, while you have explained that, I'm sure in the mind of an ordinary listener, many, many questions might be coming to them to the fore. If, for example, the wife contributes to the house, right now, what happens, and by and large, this is what is common cause in our community. The wife will contribute, and then when there is a problem, she will then sometimes blame the Sharia or blame the Islamic law to say that the Islamic law only gives me 1/8, but I gave in so much to the house. Or, for example, when there is a divorce, many people and escorts people come and then complain and then object and say that, but why don't you take into account what the wife put into the marriage? A very common question. Whenever there is a problem, and of course there is now with regard to the distribution of assets, and normally the Mufti will say that, listen, whatever is the husband's is the husband, whatever the wife is the wife's. People will say then, what about what I put into the marriage? What did I put into, I gave my inheritance, I put it into the home. The home now belongs to the husband by his name. But what about that 100,000 that I had from inheritance and I put it into the house? What about the 200,000 that I had and I put it in here and I look after the children and I gave them this and I gave them that? Now, that is where the situation comes in. When things are going well, the wife gives from her own money, nothing, there is no problem. But when there is a breakdown and now you have to separate, now the wife brings in those things. The point is, why didn't you determine that when you were spending your money? Or would it be fair to say that should have been determined when you were spending your money?
Timon, I think it's very very significant, because among the objectives of this contract is also a means of education. Hmm. At the very onset of a relationship, of a nikah, the parties need to understand what governs this. And if they are informed at that point, if you're going to contribute towards a household, it's not your responsibility as the wife, it's the husband's responsibility. But whatever you contribute, you have a right to decide at that point whether it's a gift to your husband, which you then have no right to demand later. Is it a loan? Is it a partnership towards paying the bond, for example? So the matters are very clear. There's no misunderstanding, and that's recorded in writing, and there's an agreement between them in writing.
Hmm.
It avoids any conflict in future then.
Let's continue with the contagious diseases, Murad.
Okay, there's a clause that's contained in here that the parties between them, if they do decide and agree that they'll go for testing whether they have, to see whether there are any contagious diseases or the HIV status of each of the parties, then they'll agree to that process and they'll have themselves tested.
Hmm.
This is something which might seem, you know, out of the ordinary within our community. There's two things we need to keep in mind. One is the lifestyle that we're leading. And Allah Ta'ala protect us, make us a pure, chaste society. The reality on the ground is perhaps something different.
Would, for example, people say that we are assuming that, or is it facing reality?
I think the important thing of this contract is parties must agree to what they're comfortable with. If they don't want to have this clause as part of their agreement, they can strike it out.
That's
fine. Yeah. It's a contract is something which two parties agree to. If they want to have this as part of the contract, or any other clause as part of the contract, they will include it. Whatever they want to exclude, they'll exclude. Just an important anecdote from we had a discussion with the Muslim Lawyers Association sometime recently, and they said to us they also have a similar contract. or something to this effect, where the a party was asked, or couples, that they in the contract they presented this clause here, the HIV status testing. And the attorney said that I've done two contracts in the recent past, and in both contracts, the parties had no issue in signing that. So I suppose we're coming from a different generation, perhaps there's a different generation now out there. And, you know, there's aside from, you know, us assuming, I think we're looking for security also. There's so much of insecurity with regard to marriage. We hear more and more that younger couples are very afraid to get married. Boys and girls saying, I don't want to get married, I'm too afraid. I've seen the experience my sister has had, my brother has had, my cousin has had. So I suppose it's a form of security more as rather than, you know, just being just assuming.
We've got about 9 minutes, Mufti Saab. Let's go on to the next one.
I don't know if listeners have any questions with regard to what they want. Others, they can either make a note and ask individual questions to the Jamiat itself, but if someone wants to put up something on air, by all means, it could come through.
Let's move on.
The next clause relates to mediation in the event that there is a dispute between the parties or a couple, and they do proceed or they decide that they need to terminate the marriage and go for divorce. Then before going to litigation or before deciding to go to court for having the matters of care and contact, access, visitation, issues related to the children and maintenance, they bind themselves to a process of mediation so that to avoid going to litigation and saving having an amicable outcome, which will be in the best interest of everyone, the husband, wife, and the children. There's also a clause related to the divorce settlement agreement, which the parties will then draw up as a result of the mediation. There's a clause related to talaq, which says that it is the responsibility or the right of the husband to pronounce the talaq as the shariat has given him the right. The ninth section of this contract is perhaps, which is something very different. Now, this clause here is not something which is, which it was unheard of before. The kitab that you've made reference to, Habib, the Al-Hilatu Najiza of Mullah Ashraf Ali Thani, rahmatullahi alayhi, there were some very disturbing conditions in India at the time when he prepared this kitab. And in the kitab, in the book, he makes mention of having a tafweed ut-talaq, a prenuptial contract, where parties bind themselves to a tafweed ut-talaq, which in simple words mean that the husband, in terms of the law of Shariat, has the right of pronouncing the talaq upon the wife. He gives the talaq. The wife doesn't issue a talaq. But the husband has the right to give this right over to the wife. And if he doesn't want to, or if she wants the talaq, to say to her that I'm giving this right of talaq over to you. If you wish, you can pronounce it on yourself. So it's not a right that she has by herself. It is a right that the husband has, which he is giving over to her. And once he gives the right over to her, he still retains the original right of talaq, which he can still do. What the contract has done is that under normal circumstances, a tafweed can be handed over to the wife with conditions or without conditions. He could say to her that if you wish to pronounce a talaq upon yourself, then you can pronounce a talaq either now, immediately, within a period of time, within 2 days, 3 days, 10 days, whatever.
Mufti Saab, there's a question here. Yes. Would a tafweed, obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given the right of talaq according to the sharia to the husband. By giving the tafweed over to the wife, does it take away from the objective or the plan of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
I think, again, it depends on the security that a couple need, or more important than anything that the lady needs in a relationship. So we have two types of marriages today. At the point of dissolution, the point of termination. The one where the man or the couple realize the marriage isn't going anywhere, or they're struggling, there's no future in this marriage, and as adults, they make adult decisions and terminate the marriage amicably. And then we have couples where out of spite or stubbornness or to prove a point, or some people want to just show that they are in control, whatever the reason might be, even if the husband is not fulfilling his responsibility towards his wife, or there is no future, he just holds on for ulterior motives and out of spite. In that instance, the tafweed is a form of security for a lady in that relationship. Again,
so you don't look upon it as something that would be perhaps going against the plan of Almighty Allah. You're looking at circumstances.
I think all what our experience has been is that, you know, the fear is that if this right has been given to the wife, so she'll just exercise it at any point, or she'll just for any undue reason just exercise it. The reality on the ground is that marriage is important to husband and wife, and they don't want to be out of a relationship. They don't want to be out of the marriage. Our experience has been we've dealt with a tafweed during some time last year. As difficult as the situation was, and as much as the lady wanted out of the relationship, she found it very difficult to exercise the tafweed. So we fear that they're just going to exercise it willy-nilly. It's going to be like a sword against the head of the husband. But I think marriage has objectives far, far greater than these. These fears in reality.
And of course, the Jamiat has taken the necessary precaution that the wife cannot do it unilaterally. She has to go to the Muslim judicial body, who will then appoint a committee of three people who will look into the aspect. And if they agree that she can exercise her tafweed, she can then go ahead by exercising a tafweed, even if the husband doesn't give the talaq. But it has taken the necessary precaution so that it is not used in a fit of emotion.
Yeah, we've tried to bring those conditions in so that it is controlled and not just left open to abuse.
So we've got a call on. Let's take a caller quickly. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum, Malana.
Ji, brother.
Brother, one of the final things, can this also be included? One of the things is, which is very common in our society nowadays is a person's mental status, things like dementia, schizophrenic, bipolar. You know, it's very important because we never know. That can only surface at a later stage in marriage.
I think Mufti Sahib did mention that anything you want to include can be included, and anything you want to take out, you can take out. It's a good point to raise, mashallah.
I think when we speak about the contagious diseases, I think in that, people can add other things that they might not be comfortable with as part and parcel of the contract.
So this is basically just a skeleton. Mufti Sahib, perhaps you want to continue with the tafweed or anything else on the contract?
I think we've concluded the most of the important clause of the contract. If there's any other discussions.
Okay, Mufti Sahib, where is it obtainable from and how much is it? That's a question that people are asking.
Currently, it's obtainable from all the Jamiat branches. It's 100 rands.
100 rands, it can save you thousands and millions.
That's a good point, Mulana, you make that. In a situation where the conflict arises, then this contract then kind of like saves you all that legal cost. You go to a recognized body, a judicial body, and they help you out with all these matters. It's a good point.
See, I think one of those 2 points. One is that this contract has to be, it's a prenuptial contract, which means that existing marriages, the one that we have, it doesn't govern those marriages. It governs marriages where people are intending to go into nikah. So the contract has to be done prior to the nikah, and then imam must make mention of it at the point of nikah. He needs to say that I'm concluding this marriage with the terms referred to in the prenuptial contract that the parties have adopted between them. The other important thing is to keep in mind is that we've workshopped a number of ulama around all the different towns that fall under the purview of the Jamiat. So the Jamiat has representation in 6 provinces. We've had a workshop and we've workshopped this with the ulama of all of those regions. We don't want people just to purchase a copy of this contract and go and do it on their own without understanding what they are signing. We want them to sit with an alim who can go through the terms of those contracts and see whether they're comfortable with it or not. We don't want to bind someone to someone with something where later on they realize and they feel that we've been forced into this, or we've been hoodwinked, we didn't understand what we're signing. We don't want that to happen. We want people to make a conscious decision and need to understand what is contained in this. Therefore, just to purchase it from the Jamiat, I think that's not what we're looking at. We're looking at for them to contact the Jamiat, schedule an appointment with a relevant person at the office, go through the contract and then sign it, and then make amendments if amendments need to be made.
Obviously, that after conferring the delegation of talaq, the husband, according to Sharia, will retain his original vested responsibility with regard to talaq. It's not only a right, but is it together with a right that comes a commensurate responsibility?
Gee.
What if someone, I mean, see what the Jamiat has put, not only the contract, but has also put guidelines. And if people do agree upon this, then the person who will make the nikah will announce at the time of nikah that I'm performing this nikah, and this nikah has been agreed upon by the couples on a pre-agreed contract. So that will also become part and parcel of the nakih, or the person making the nikah, saying that in the nikah, when the nikah is performed.
Yeah, the new jamiat, the jamiat must put it in a new nikah box for us. No, they must include it one statement there on top.
Right. Yeah. Well, you want to say that, anything on that, Muslim?
No, someone just sent me a message now. They're saying that we should just clarify nikah, that talaq is not the right of the husband, it is a responsibility.
Yes.
I think it is a right that comes with a responsibility.
Yes. That's a comments with responsibility.
Yeah.
Jazakumullah khairan, Mufti Sahib and Mala Abam. Inshallah, we'll pick up on some other issues next week. Until we meet, assalam.